Henry Kendall was overwhelmed. He walked into the bedroom to think things through. He had just come back from the police station, where he reviewed the playground security camera tape from the day before. The image quality wasn't that good, thank God, because the image of that kid Billy kicking and beating his son was so upsetting he could hardly watch. He had to look away several times. And those other boys, that gang of skaters, they should all be in jail. With any luck, they'd be expelled from school. But Henry knew it wouldn't end there. It never did. Everybody sued these days, and no doubt the skater parents would sue to have their kids reinstated. They'd sue Henry's family, and they'd sue Jamie and Dave. And out of those lawsuits, it was sure to emerge that there was no such thing as Gandalf-Cricky syndrome, or whatever it was that Lynn had made up. It was sure to emerge that Dave was in reality a transgenic chimp. And then what? A media circus beyond all imagining. Reporters camped on the front lawn for weeks, chasing them wherever they went, filming them with spy cameras day and night, destroying their lives. And around the time the reporters got bored, the religious people and the environmentalists would start in. Henry and his family would be called godless. They'd be called criminals. They'd be called dangerous and un-American and a threat to the biosphere. In his mind, he saw commentators on TV in a babble of languages. English, Spanish, German, Japanese, all talking with pictures of him and Dave in the background. And that was just the beginning. Dave would be taken away. Henry could possibly go to jail, though he doubted that. Scientists had been breaking the rules about genetic testing for 2 decades, and none had ever gone to jail, even when patients died. But he would certainly be barred from research. He could be kicked out of the lab for a year or more. How would he support his family? Lynn couldn't do it alone, and her web business would almost certainly dry up. And what would happen to Dave? And his son? To Tracy? And what about their community? La Jolla was pretty liberal, parts of it anyway, but people might not be understanding about the idea of a human Z going to school with their kids. It was radical, no doubt about it. People weren't ready for it. Liberals were only so liberal. They might have to move. They might have to sell their house and go somewhere remote, like Montana, though maybe people would be even less accepting of them there. These and other thoughts raced through his mind, to the accompaniment of cars squealing and crashing into each other, and his wife and her friend laughing in the kitchen. He felt overwhelmed, and in the middle of it, at the center of everything, was his deep sense of guilt. One thing was clear. He had to keep track of his kids. He had to know where they were. He couldn't risk further incidents like the one that had occurred the day before. Lynn had kept the children at home for an extra hour, intending to let them go to school later so there wouldn't be any incidents with older kids. That Cleaver kid was a menace, and it wasn't likely he was jailed. They'd probably just scare him and give him over to the custody of his father. The father, Henry knew, was a defense analyst for a local think tank and a hard-ass gun nut. One of those intellectuals who liked to shoot things. A manly intellectual. There was no telling what could happen. He turned to the package he had brought home from the lab. It was marked Track Tech Industries, Chiba City, Japan. Inside were 5-inch-long polished silver tubes, slightly thinner than soda straws. He pulled them out and looked at them. These marvels of miniaturization had GPS technology built in, as well as monitors for temperature, pulse, respiration, and blood pressure. They were activated by a magnet that you touched at one end. The tip glowed blue once, then nothing. They were designed to keep track of lab primates, monkeys, and baboons. The tubes were inserted with a special surgical instrument that looked like an oversized syringe. They were placed under the skin of the neck, just above the clavicle. Henry couldn't do that to the kids, of course. So the question was, where to put them? He went back to the living room where the kids were. Dropped the sensors in their school bags? No. Down the collars of their shirts? He shook his head. They'd feel them. Then where? The surgical instrument worked perfectly. The devices went smoothly into the rubber at the heel of the sneaker. He did it for Dave's sneaker, then for Jamie's, then, on an impulse, went out and got a sneaker from Alex's son, Jamie, as well. "What for?" Jamie said. "I need to measure it. Back in a sec." He inserted another device into the third sneaker. That left two more. Henry thought about it for a while. Several possibilities came to mind. The Hummer pulled up behind the ambulance and Vasco got out. He walked up to the ambulance. Dolly slid over onto the passenger seat. "What's happening?" Vasco said as he got in. Dolly nodded to the house at the end of the street. "That's the Kendall place. You see Burnett's car in front. She's been in there an hour." Vasco frowned. "What's going on?" She shook her head. "I could get the directional mic, but we have to be straight on to the windows, and I figured you didn't want me to pull up closer."
"Right, I don't."
Vasco leaned back in his seat. He gave a long sigh. He looked at his watch.
"Well, we can't go in there."
Bounty hunters were permitted to enter the premises of the fugitive, even without a search warrant, but they could not enter the premises of third parties, even if they knew the fugitive was there.
"Sooner or later," he said, "they gotta come out. And when they do, we'll be here."
Gerard was tired. He had been flying for an hour since his last stop, which had been something of a disaster. Shortly after dawn, he had landed at a complex of buildings where he smelled food. The buildings were made of wood with faded paint. There were old cars with grass growing up around them. Large animals made snorting sounds behind a fence. He stood on a fence post and watched a young boy in blue coveralls walking out with a bucket in his hand. Gerard smelled food. "I'm hungry," he said. The young boy turned. He looked around briefly, then continued on his way. "I want food," Gerard said. "I am hungry." The boy paused again. He looked around again. "What's the matter? Don't you know how to talk?" Gerard said. "Yes," the kid said. "Where are you?"
"Here."
The kid squinted. He walked over to the fence. "My name is Gerard."
"No kidding. You can talk?"
"How thrilling for you," Gerard said. He could smell the bucket strongly now. He smelled corn and other grains. He could also smell something else that smelled bad, but his hunger overwhelmed him.
"I want food."
"What food do you want?" the kid said. He reached into the bucket and scooped up a handful of feed.
"You want this?"
Gerard bent over, tasted it. He spit it out at once.
"Yuck! It's chicken feed. Nothing wrong with it. They eat it."
"Do you have any fresh vegetables?"
The kid laughed.
"You're funny. You sound like British. What's your name?"
"Gerard. An orange? Do you have an orange?" He hopped back and forth on the fence post, impatient.
"I like an orange." How come you talk so good?
I could ask the same of you. You know what? I'm going to show you to my dad, the kid said. He held out his hand. You're tame, aren't you?
Sink me.
Gerard stepped on his hand. The kid put Gerard on his shoulder. He started walking back to the wooden building.
I bet we can sell you for a lot of money, he said.
Gerard gave a squawk and flew up to the roof of one building.
Hey, come back!
From inside the house, a voice.
Jared, do your chores!
Gerard watched as the kid reluctantly turned back to a dirt yard where he tossed handfuls of the grain from the bucket onto the ground. A group of yellow birds clucked and jumped as the food was thrown to them. They looked incredibly stupid. It took a moment before Gerard decided that he would eat that food after all. He flew down and made a loud squawk to drive away the stupid birds, then started eating their grain. It tasted disgusting, but he had to eat something. Meanwhile, the kid dived for him, hands outstretched. Gerard flew into the air, pecked the kid hard on the nose. The kid screamed, and then dropped down a short distance away to eat again. These big yellow birds were all around him.
Get back! Get back, all of you!
The yellow birds paid little attention. Gerard made the sound of a siren. The kid dived again, barely missing Gerard. He was obviously a stupid kid.
Buffeting, buffeting, 20,000 feet, buffeting. I am going to push the stick forward.
Then the sound of a huge, air-shattering explosion. The chickens scattered at that, and he had a moment of peace, eating a little. Now the kid was back with a net, and was swiping downward with it. That was too much excitement for Gerard, who was feeling sick in the stomach from the horrid food, so he flew quickly into the air, evacuating and hitting the kid perfectly on the head, before he climbed into blue sky and went on his way. 20 minutes later, in cooler air, he came to the coast and followed it. It was easier here because there were updrafts, a blessing to his tired wings. He could not soar, but it helped nonetheless. He experienced a modest sense of peace. At least he did until some giant white bird, enormously huge, gigantic, rushed silently up at him, whooshing past, creating spinning turbulence that tumbled him out of control. When Gerard got his bearings again, the bird had glided away from him on huge, flat wings. There was a single eye in the center of the head. It glinted in the sun, and the wings never moved. They just remained straight and flat. Gerard was grateful there was not a flock of these birds, but instead only one. He watched as it circled slowly toward the ground below, and that was when he noticed the beautiful green oasis in the midst of the dry coast. An oasis! It was built at the site of a large cluster of huge boulders. Surrounding the boulders were palm trees and luscious gardens and pretty buildings nestled among the green. Gerard felt certain that there would be food there. It was so inviting. He spiraled down. It was a kind of dream. Beautiful people in white robes walking silently through a garden of flowers and shrubs, in the cool shade of palm trees, with all sorts of birds flittering about. He did not smell food here, but he was sure there must be some. And then he smelled orange. Cut orange. It took him only a moment to locate another bird, brilliant blue and red, standing on a perch with lots of oranges all around him on a tray below. Oranges and avocado and bits of lettuce. Cautiously, Gerard landed next to him.
I want you to want me, he said.
Hello,
blue and red bird said.
I need you to need me.
Hello.
Nice place you got here.
My name is Gerard.
What's up, Doc?
The bird said. Mind if I have an orange?
Hello,
the bird said.
What's up, Doc?
I said, I would like an orange.
Hello.
Gerard lost patience. He went for the orange. The blue and red bird pecked at him viciously. Gerard dodged and flapped away with the orange in his mouth. He sat on a tree branch and looked back. That was when he saw that the other bird was chained to the perch. Gerard ate the orange at his leisure. Then he flew back for more. He came at the perch from behind, then later from the side. He flew in unexpectedly, each time dodging the bird, who could only say, "Hello." After half an hour, he was quite satisfied. Meanwhile, he watched the people in white robes come and go, talking of NyQuil and Jell-O. He said, "Jell-O, the tasty dessert for the whole family, now with more Kelsey. Yum!" Two of the people in robes looked up. Someone laughed, then continued on their way. This place was peaceful. The water gurgled in little brooks beside the path. He would stay here, Gerard felt certain, for a long, long time.
"Okay, we got action," Vasco said.
Two young kids were coming out of the Kendall house. One was a dark kid in a baseball cap, sort of bow-legged. The other was fair, also in a baseball cap, wearing khakis and a sport shirt.
"Looks like Jamie,"
he said, putting the car in gear. They drove slowly forward. "I don't know," Dolly said. "Doesn't look quite the same."
"It's the baseball hat. Just ask him,"
Vasco said. Dolly rolled down her window. She leaned out. "Jamie, honey." The boy turned. "Yes," he said. Dolly jumped out of the car. Henry Kendall was working at the computer, activating the track tech, when he heard the high-pitched scream from outside. He knew at once that it was Dave. He bolted up and ran for the door. Behind him was Lynn, running from the kitchen. But he noticed that Alex stayed in the kitchen with her arms around her son, Jamie. She looked terrified. Dave was confused by what he saw. Jamie spoke to the woman in the big white car, and then she jumped out and grabbed him. Dave was not inclined to attack females, so he watched as the woman scooped up Jamie, took him to the back of the white car, and opened the back doors. Dave saw a man inside in a white coat, and he saw lots of shiny equipment that frightened him. Jamie must have been frightened, too, because suddenly he was screaming, and then the woman slammed the back door shut. Before the car started moving, Dave screamed and leaped onto the back, grabbing the handles on the door. The white car accelerated forward, going fast. Dave held on, struggling to keep his balance. When he had a good grip, he pulled up so he could look through the rear windows. He saw the man in the coat and the woman pushing Jamie onto a bed, trying to tie him down. Jamie was screaming. Dave felt rage flood through his body. He snarled and banged at the doors. The woman looked up in alarm. She seemed shocked to see Dave. She yelled something to the driver. The driver started to swerve the white car. Dave was flung sideways, barely able to hold on to the recessed door handles. When the car swung him back once more, he reached high, grabbing the lights above the doors. He pulled himself onto the top of the ambulance. The wind blew hard. The surface was smooth. He lay flat, inching forward. The car straightened out, drove more slowly. He heard yelling inside. He crept forward. "We lost him," Dolly yelled, looking out the back window.
"What was it?"
"Looked like an ape."
"He's not an ape. He's my friend,"
Jamie yelled, struggling.
"He goes to school with me."
The kid's baseball cap fell off, and Dolly saw that he had dark brown hair. She said, "What's your name?"
"Jamie. Jamie Kendall."
"Oh, no," she said.
"Oh, Christ,"
Vasco said, driving.
You got the wrong kid?
He said his name was Jamie.
It's the wrong kid. Jesus Christ, you're an idiot, Dolly. This is kidnapping.
Well, it's not my fault.
Whose fault do you think it is? You saw the kid, too.
I didn't see. You were looking right out there.
Christ, shut up. Stop arguing. We gotta take him back.
What do you mean?
We gotta take him back where we found him. It's goddamn kidnapping.
And then Vasco swore and screamed. Dave was on the roof of the cab, wedged between the light bar and the slope of the ambulance. He leaned over the driver's side. There was a big side mirror there. He could see an ugly, black-bearded man driving and shouting. He knew the man was going to hurt Jamie. He could see the man baring his teeth in a sign of rage. Dave leaned down, resting his weight on the side mirror, and swung his arm in through the open window. His strong fingers grabbed the bearded man by the nose, and the man yelled and jerked his head. Dave's fingers slipped, but he lunged back and bit down hard on the man's ear and held on. The man was screaming at him in rage. Dave could feel that rage, but he had plenty of his own. He pulled hard and felt the ear come away with a gush of hot blood. The man screamed and spun the wheel. The ambulance tilted, the left wheels came up off the ground, and the vehicle slowly turned over and crashed down on its right side. The sound of screeching metal was incredibly loud. Dave was riding the ambulance down as it fell, but he lost his grip on impact. His feet slammed into the face of the bearded man, and one of his shoes went right into his mouth. The vehicle slid to a stop on its side. The man was biting and coughing. The woman inside was screaming. Dave pulled his foot out of his shoe, leaving it in the bearded man's mouth. Blood was gushing everywhere from the man's ear. He yanked off the other shoe, scampered around to the back of the ambulance, and managed with some effort to get the doors open. The white coat man was lying on his side, bleeding from his mouth. Jamie was underneath the man, yelling. Dave dragged the white coat man out of the car, dropped him onto the street. Then he went and got Jamie, put him on his back, and ran, carrying him back to their house. Jamie said, "Are you hurt?" The ear was still in Dave's mouth. He spit it into his hand.
"No."
"What's that in your hand?"
Dave opened his fist. "It's an ear."
"Ugh! Ooh!"
"I bit his ear. He was bad. He hurted you. Ack!"
Up ahead, they saw everybody standing out on the front lawn of their house. Henry and Lynn and the new people, too. Dave put Jamie on the ground, and he ran to his parents. Dave waited for his mother, Lynn, to comfort him, but she was entirely focused on Jamie. It made him feel bad. He dropped the ear in his hand on the ground. Everybody was swirling around him, but nobody touched him. Nobody put their fingers in his fur. He felt more and more sad. Then he saw the boxy black car barreling down the street toward them. It was huge, high off the ground, and it drove right up onto the lawn. The Oxnard courtroom was small and so cold Bob Koch thought he would catch pneumonia. He was feeling none too good anyway. His hangover had left a very sour feeling in his stomach. The judge was a youngish guy, about 40, and he looked hungover, too, but maybe not. Koch cleared his throat.
"Your Honor, I am here representing Alexandra Burnett, who is unable to be here in person."
"This court has ordered her to appear," the judge said, "in person."
"I am aware of that, Your Honor. But she and her child are presently being pursued by a bounty hunter who intends to remove tissue from their bodies, and she is therefore in flight to prevent that."
"What bounty hunter?" the judge said. Why is there a bounty hunter involved in this?
We would like to know exactly that, Your Honor,
Bob Koch said. The judge turned.
Mr. Rodriguez?
Your Honor, Rodriguez said, standing, there is no bounty hunter per se.
Well, what is there?
There is a professional fugitive recovery agent at work.
With what authorization?
He is not authorized per se. In this case, he is making a citizen's arrest, Your Honor.
Arrest of whom?
Of Ms. Burnett and her son.
On what basis?
Possession of stolen property, Your Honor.
To make a citizen's arrest, the possession of stolen property has to be witnessed by the person making the arrest.
Yes, Your Honor.
What has been witnessed?
The possession of the property in question, Your Honor.
You are talking about the Burnett cell line?
The judge said.
Yes, Your Honor. As previously documented before this court, that cell line is owned by UCLA and licensed to Biogen in Westview. The ownership is attested to by several prior court rulings.
How, then, is it stolen?
Your Honor, we have evidence that Mr. Burnett conspired to eliminate the cell lines in possession of Biogen. But whether that is true or not, Biogen has the right to restore the cell lines that it owns.
It can restore them from Mr. Burnett.
Yes, Your Honor, presumably so, since the court has ruled that Mr. Burnett's cells belong to Biogen, they can at any time take more. Whether the property is actually within Mr. Burnett's body or not is immaterial. Biogen owns the cells.
You are denying Mr. Burnett's right to the integrity of his body?
The judge said, raising an eyebrow.
With respect, Your Honor, there is no such right. Suppose someone took your wife's diamond ring and swallowed it. The ring is still your property.
Yes, the judge said, but I might be required to wait patiently for it to reappear.
Yes, Your Honor, but suppose for some reason the ring becomes stuck in the intestine. Don't you have the right to retrieve it?
Clearly, you do.
It can't be kept from you. It's your property wherever it is. Whoever swallows it assumes the risk of retrieval.
Koch thought he'd better move in.
Your Honor, he said, if I remember my high school biology correctly, anything swallowed is not actually inside the body, any more than something inside a donut hole is inside the donut. The ring is outside the body.
Rodriguez began to sputter.
Your Honor!
Your Honor, Koch said, raising his voice, I trust we can all agree that we are not talking about diamond rings that have been stolen. We're talking about cells that reside inside the human body. The notion that these cells can be owned by someone else, even if the appellate court has upheld a jury finding, leads to absurd conclusions, as you see here. If Biogen no longer possesses Mr. Burnett's cells, then they have lost them by their own foolish actions. They are not entitled to go back and get more. If you lose your diamond ring, you can't go back to the diamond mine and get a replacement.
Rodriguez said, The analogy is inexact.
Your Honor, all analogies are inexact.
In this instance, Rodriguez said, I would ask the court to stick narrowly to the issue at hand and consider the previous findings of the court that are relevant to the issue. The court has held that Biogen owns these cells. They came from Mr. Burnett, but they are the property of Biogen. We argue that we have the right to retrieve these cells at any time.
Your Honor, this argument directly conflicts with the 13th Amendment against chattel slavery. Biogen may own Mr. Burnett's cells, but they don't own Mr. Burnett. They can't.
We never claim to own Mr. Burnett, only his cells, and that is all we are asking for now. Rodriguez said. But the practical consequence of your claim is that you effectively own Mr. Burnett, since you do claim access to his body at any time. The judge was looking weary. Gentlemen, I see the issue, he said. But what does any of this have to do with Ms. Burnett and her son? Bob Koch stepped back. Let Rodriguez bury himself on this one, he thought. The conclusion he was asking the court to draw was inconceivable. Your Honor, Rodriguez said, if the court accepts that Mr. Burnett's cells are my client's property, as I believe it must, then said cells are my client's property wherever they are found. For example, if Mr. Burnett gave blood at a blood bank, the donated blood would contain cells that we own. We could assert ownership of those cells and demand to extract them from the donated blood, since Mr. Burnett is not legally able to give those cells to anyone else. They are our property. Similarly, the same cells that we own, the identical cells, are also found in Mr. Burnett's children and descendants. Therefore, we have ownership of those cells as well, and we have the right to take the cells. And the bounty hunter? The fugitive recovery specialist, Rodriguez said, is making a citizen's arrest on the following basis. If he sees Mr. Burnett's descendants, then since they are by definition walking around with our property, they are self-evidently in possession of stolen property and can be arrested. The judge sighed. Your Honor, Rodriguez said, this conclusion may strike the court as illogical, but the fact is that we are in a new era, and what seems strange to us now will in a few years not seem so strange. Already a large percentage of the human genome is owned. The genetic information for various disease organisms is owned. The notion that such biological elements are in private hands is only odd because it is new to us. But the court must rule in accordance with previous findings. The Burnett cells are our cells. But in the case of descendants, the cells are copies, the judge said. Yes, Your Honor, but that is not at issue. If I own a formula to make something, and someone Xeroxes that formula on a sheet of paper and gives it to another, it remains my property. I own the formula, no matter how it is copied or by whom. And I have the right to retrieve the copy. The judge turned to Bob Koch. Mr. Koch?
Your Honor, Mr. Rodriguez has asked you to rule narrowly.
So do I. Previous courts held that once Mr. Burnett's cells were out of his body, they no longer belonged to him. They did not say that Mr. Burnett was a walking gold mine that could be plundered at will again and again by Biogen. And they certainly said nothing to imply that Biogen had a right to physically take these cells no matter who carried them. That claim goes far beyond any implication of the court's prior finding. It is, in fact, a new claim made out of nothing but wishful thinking. And we ask the court to require Biogen to call off this bounty hunter. The judge said, I do not understand on what basis Biogen has simply acted on its own, Mr. Rodriguez. This appears hasty and unwarranted. You could certainly wait for Miss Burnett to appear before this court. Unfortunately, Your Honor, that is not possible. The business situation of my client is critical. As I said to you, we believe we are victims of a conspiracy to deprive us of what is ours. Without going into details, it is urgent that the cells be replaced immediately. If the court forces a delay, we may lose an enormous business undertaking in the meanwhile, such that our company goes out of business. We merely attempt a timely response to an urgent problem. Bob could tell the judge was going for it. all that timeliness crap was working on him. He didn't want to be responsible for putting a California biotech company out of business. The judge swiveled in his chair, glanced at the wall clock, swiveled back. Bob had to pull it out, and he had to do it now.
"Your Honor," he said, "there is an additional issue that bears on your decision. I would like to bring to your attention the following affidavit from Duke University Medical Center, dated today." He handed a copy to Rodriguez. "I will summarize the contents for Your Honor and how it affects the issue before you."
Burnett's cell line, he explained, was capable of making large quantities of a chemical called cytotoxic TLA-7D, a potent anti-carcinogen. It was that chemical that made Biogen's cell line so valuable.
"However, last week the U.S. Patent Office issued a patent for the gene TLA-4A. This is a promoter gene that codes for an enzyme that snips out a hydroxy group from the center of a protein called cytotoxic T-lymphocyte-associated protein 4B. This protein is the precursor of cytotoxic TLA-7D, which forms when the hydroxy group is removed. Unless the hydroxy group is snipped out, the protein has no biological activity. So the gene that controls the manufacture of Biogen's product is owned by Duke University, and they assert ownership in the document now in your hands."
Rodriguez was turning very red. "Your Honor," he said, "this is an attempt to confuse what should be a very simple case. I would urge that you..."
"It is simple," Bob agreed. "Unless Biogen makes a licensing agreement with Duke, they cannot use the enzyme made by the Duke gene. The enzyme and its product are owned by someone else."
"But this is..."
"Biogen owns a cell, Your Honor," Bob said, "but not all the genes inside that cell."
The judge looked again at the clock. "I will take this under advisement," he said, "and give you my ruling tomorrow."
"But, Your Honor..."
"Thank you, gentlemen. Arguments are concluded."
"But, Your Honor, we have a woman and her son being hounded..."
"I believe I understand the issue. I need to understand the law. I will see you tomorrow, counselors." The Kendalls were screaming as the Hummer raced forward, but Vasco Borden, snarling through his aching teeth, one hand holding the bandage against his bleeding ear, knew what he was doing. He drove the car up onto the lawn and pulled to a stop, blocking the front door. Then he and Dolly jumped out, grabbed Alex's Jamie off the lawn, pushed the kid's stunned mother to the ground, leapt back into the Hummer, and roared off, while the others just stood there and stared.
"Just like that, baby," Vasco said, shouting. "If you're not inside the house, you're mine."
He roared off down the street.
"We lost our ambulance, so we go to Plan B."
He looked back over his shoulder.
"Dolly, honey, get the next operating room going. Tell him we'll be there in 20 minutes. 1 hour from now, this is all a done deal."
Henry Kendall was in shock. There had been a kidnapping right on his front lawn. He hadn't rushed forward to stop it. His own son was sobbing and clutching his mother, and Dave had dropped some guy's ear on the lawn. The other kid's mother was getting to her feet, screaming for the cops, but the Hummer was gone, down the street and around the corner, and gone. He felt weak and emasculated, as if he'd somehow done something wrong, and he was embarrassed to be around Lynn's friend, so he went inside and sat down again at the computer. It was just where he had been sitting 5 minutes before, when Dave screamed and all this started. He still had the TrackTech website up, where he'd entered the names and the serial numbers. He had done it for Dave and for Jamie, but he hadn't done it for the other Jamie. Feeling bad, he did it now. The website switched to a blank, featureless map with an entry spot where you typed in the unit you were looking for. The first unit he entered was Jamie Burnett's. If the sensor was operating, he would have seen it moving down the street, but the blue spot wasn't moving. It was static. The address showed 348 Marbury Madison Drive, which was his own house. He looked around the living room and saw Jamie's white sneakers over in the corner with his little travel bag. He'd never even put the sneakers back on. Next, he typed in the sensor for his own son. Same result. The blue spot was fixed at his own home address. Then it moved a little, and his son Jamie walked through the door. "Dad, what are you doing? The police are outside. They want to talk to everybody." "Okay, in a minute."
"His mom is really upset, Dad."
"In a minute."
"She's crying. Mom said to get a tissue."
"I'll be right with you." Quickly, Henry typed in the third serial number, Dave's number. The screen went blank. He waited a moment. He saw the map as it was redrawn. It now showed roads leading north of town in the area of Torrey Pines. The blue dot was moving. North, Torrey Pines Road, east-northeast, 57 miles per hour. As he watched, the dot turned off onto Gaylord Road heading inland. Somehow Dave's sensor was in the Hummer. It either came out of his shoe or they had taken his shoe, but the sensor was there and working. He said, "Jamie, go get Alex. Tell her I need to see her for a minute."
"But, Dad..."
"Do it, and don't say anything to the police." Alex stared at the screen. "I'm going to get that son of a bitch, and I'm going to blow his head off. You touch my kid, you're dead." Her voice was flat, cold. Henry felt a chill. She meant it. "Where's he going?" she said. "He's left the coast and heading inland. But he may just be avoiding the Del Mar traffic. He may go back to the coast again. We'll know in a few minutes."
"How far away is he?"
10 minutes.
"Let's go. You bring that,"
she said, nodding to the laptop.
"I'll get my gun."
Henry looked out the front window. There were 3 cop cars flashing their lights at the curb and 6 cops on the front lawn. Not that easy.
"Yes, it is. I'm parked around the corner."
"They said they want to see me."
"Make an excuse. I'll be in my car."
He told them Dave needed medical attention, and he had to take him to the hospital. He said that his wife, Lynn, had witnessed everything and could tell them what had taken place. He said he would give a full statement when he returned, but he needed to take Dave to the hospital. Since Dave's hands were bloody, they accepted it. Lynn gave Henry a funny look. He said, "I'll be back as soon as I can." He walked around the back of the house and cut through the property behind. Dave followed him.
"Where are we going?"
Dave said. "To find that guy, the guy with the black beard."
"He hurted Jamie."
"Yeah, I know."
"I hurted him, too."
"Yeah, I know."
"His ears came off."
"Uh-huh."
"Next time, his nose."
"Dave," he said, "we need to show restraint."
"What's restraint?"
Dave said. It was too complicated to explain. Alex's white Toyota was up ahead. They got in the car. He got in front. Dave got in back.
"What is this?"
Dave said, pointing to the seat beside him.
"Don't touch it, Dave,"
Alex said. "That's a gun." She put the car in gear and drove off. She called Bob Koch on the off chance that he had news.
"I do," he said, "but I wish it were better."
"He let it go?"
"He held over until tomorrow."
"Did you try?"
"Yeah, I tried. He's confused. It's not the usual legal area for Oxnard judges. That's probably why they filed there."
"So tomorrow?"
"Yeah."
"Thanks,"
she said and hung up. There was no point in telling him what she was about to do. She wasn't even sure she would do it. but she thought that she probably would. Henry was riding shotgun, looking at the computer. Now that he was out here in a car, the connection sometimes dropped out for a minute or two. He began to worry about losing it altogether. He glanced back at Dave, who was shoeless. "Where are your shoes?"
"They came off."
"Where?"
"In the white car."
He meant the ambulance.
"How?" "One was in his mouth, the man. Then the car falled."
"And your shoes came off?"
"Yes, they came off."
Apparently Alex was thinking the same thing, because she said, "Then his shoes are still in the ambulance, not the Hummer. We're following the wrong car."
"No,
the ambulance crashed. It can't be the ambulance."
"Then the signal..."
"It must have fallen out of his shoe and slipped into the guy's clothes somehow."
"Then it could slip out again."
"Yeah, it could."
"Or they could find it."
"Yeah." She didn't say anything after that. He continued watching the screen. The blue dot went north, then east, then north, and finally east again, passing Rancho Santa Fe, going back to the desert. Then it curved onto Highland Drive.
"Okay," he said. "I know where they're going. Solano Canyon."
"What's that?"
"It's a spa, very big, very high-end."
"With doctors?"
"I'm sure. They may even do surgery. Maybe facelifts, liposuction, something like that."
"Then they have surgical facilities," she said grimly. She stepped on the accelerator. The 100 acres known as Solana Canyon represented a triumph of marketing. Only a few decades earlier, the region was known by its original name, Hellhole Palms. It was a flat, boulder-strewn region without a canyon in sight. The Solana Canyon had no canyon, and precious little to do with the coastal town of Solana Beach. The name simply tracked better than the other choices, which had been Angel Springs, Zen Mountain View, Cedar Springs, and Silver Hill Ashram. Compared to the other choices, the name Solana Canyon conveyed a muted, understated quality in keeping with a resort that charged thousands of dollars a day to rejuvenate the bodies, minds, and spirits of its clients. This was accomplished through a combination of yoga, massage, meditation, spiritual counseling, and diet help, all delivered by staff who greeted guests with prayerful hands and a heartfelt namaste. Solana Canyon was also a favorite spot for celebrities to dry out. Alex drove right past the adobe-style main gate, artfully concealed behind giant palms. They were following the tracking signal, which was going around the back of the resort. "He's taking the service entrance," Henry said.
"You've been here before?"
"Once, a lecture on genetics."
"And?"
"I wasn't invited back. They didn't like the message. You know the old saying, professors attribute the intelligence of their students to environment and the intelligence of their children to genes. Same with rich people. If you're rich or good-looking, you want to hear that your genes make you that way. That enables you to feel inherently superior to other people, that you deserve your success. And then you can give other people as much crap as you..."
"Hold on. They're stopping. Slow down."
"What now?" she said. They were on a side road, and there was a service entrance up ahead.
"I think they're in the parking lot."
"So? Let's get them right there."
"No."
He shook his head. "There's always a couple of security guys at the parking lot. You show a gun, and there'll be trouble." He watched the screen. Stationary. Now moving again. Now stationary. He frowned.
She said, "If there's security guards, they'll see Jamie struggling when he gets out."
"Maybe they've drugged him, or I don't know," he said quickly, seeing the pain on her face.
"Wait. Moving again. They're going around the back road."
She put the car in gear and drove to the service gate. The gate was open. Nobody was on duty. She drove through into the parking lot. The back road was at the far corner of the lot.
"What do we do?" she said. "Follow them down the road?"
I don't think so. If we do, they'll see us coming. Better park. He opened the door. Let's take a walk through beautiful Solana Canyon Resort. He looked at her. You're going to leave that shotgun here?
No,
she said. She popped open the trunk, found a towel, wrapped the shotgun in it, and said, I'm ready.
Okay, Henry said. Here we go.
God damn it,
Vasco said, stepping on the brakes. He was driving around the back road to park behind the Surges Center. The plan was for Dr. Manuel Cajal to come out of the Surges Center, slip into the Hummer, do the biopsies, and go out again. Nobody sees it, nobody's the wiser. But now the back road was blocked. Two backhoes digging some big trench. No way across, and no other road. 100 yards from the Surges Center.
Damn, 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 he said.
Take it easy, Vasco, Dolly said. It's no big deal. If the road is blocked, we just walk to the center, go in the rear door, and do it there.
Everyone will see us walking through the resort.
So what? We're just visitors. Besides, everybody at this place is completely self-absorbed. They have no time to think about us. And if they did, and if they decided to call someone, which they never would, the procedure'd be finished before the call was finished. Manuel can do it faster in there than out here.
I don't like it.
Vasco looked around, stared at the road, then at the spa grounds. But she was right. It was a quick walk through the garden. He turned to the kid.
Listen, he said. This is how it is. We're going to take a walk. You just be quiet, and everything'll be fine.
What are you going to do? He said. To me.
Nothing. Just take a little blood.
Are there needles?
Just a little one, like at the doctor's.
He turned to Dolly.
Okay. Call Manuel. Tell him we're coming, and let's get going.
Jamie had been diligently taught to yell and scream and kick if anyone ever tried to kidnap him, and he had done those things when they first grabbed him, but now he was very frightened, and he was afraid they would hurt him if he made any trouble. So he walked quietly along the path of the garden, with the woman keeping her hand on his shoulder and the big mean guy walking on the other side, wearing a cowboy hat so his ear wouldn't show. They passed people in bathrobes, women mostly, chatting and laughing, but nobody really looked at them. They walked on through another garden area, and then he heard a voice say, I say, do you need help with your homework? He was so startled, he stopped. He looked up. It was a bird, a sort of gray-colored bird. Are you a friend of Evan? The bird said. No. He said. You're the same size as he is. What's 11 take away 9? Jamie was so surprised, he just stared. Let's go, dear, Dolly said. It's just a bird.
Just a bird? The bird said. Who are you calling a bird?
You really talk a lot, Jamie said.
And you don't, the bird said. Who are these people? Why are they holding you?
We're not holding him. Dolly said.
You gentlemen aren't really trying to kill my son, are you? The bird said.
Oh, Christ, Vasco said. Oh, Christ, the bird said,
exactly duplicating his voice.
What's your name?
Let's get going, Vasco said.
My name is Jamie, Jamie said.
Hello, Jamie. I'm Gerard, the bird said.
Hello, Gerard.
All right, Vasco said. Let's get a move on here.
That depends on who's in the saddle, Gerard said.
Dolly, Vasco said, we have to keep to our schedule.
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother, the bird said in an odd voice.
Do you know my mother? Jamie said.
No, son, Dolly said. He doesn't. He's just saying things he's already heard before.
Your story didn't sound quite right, Gerard said,
and in a different voice,
Oh, that's too bad. You got a better one?
But now the grown-ups were pushing Jamie forward. He didn't think he could stay longer, and he didn't want to make a scene.
"Bye, Gerard," he said.
"Bye, Jamie."
They walked on for a while. Jamie said,
"He was funny."
"Yes, he was, dear,"
Dolly said, keeping her hand firmly on his shoulder. Coming into the gardens, Alex first passed the swimming pool area. It was the quietest swimming pool she had ever seen. No splashing, no noise. People lay in the sun like corpses. There was a cabinet stacked with towels and bathrobes. Alex took a bathrobe and draped it over her shoulder, covering the towel-wrapped shotgun.
"How do you know these things?" Henry said, watching her. He was nervous, walking with her while she carried that gun and knowing she intended to use it. He didn't know if the bearded guy was armed, but chances were that he was.
"Law school," she said, laughing. Dave walked a couple of steps behind them. Henry turned and said, "Keep up, Dave."
"Okay."
They rounded a corner, passed beneath an adobe archway, came into another secluded garden. The air here was cool and the path shaded. A little brook ran alongside the path. They heard a voice say,
"Mellow greetings, Yuki Dookie."
Henry looked up. What was that?
"Me?"
Henry said. "It's a bird."
"Excuse me," the bird said. "My name is Gerard."
Alex said, "Oh, a talking parrot." The parrot said,
"My name is Jamie."
"Hello, Jamie. I'm Gerard."
"Hello, Gerard."
Alex froze, stared.
"That's Jamie." "Do you know my mother?"
the bird said, sounding exactly like Jamie's voice.
"Jamie!"
Alex started to shout in the garden.
"Jamie! Jamie!"
And in the distance she heard,
"Mom!"
Dave took off, running forward. Henry looked at Alex, who stood very still. She dropped the towel and the robe to the ground and methodically loaded the shotgun. She pulled the action bar back and forward, making a chunk-chunk sound. Then she turned to Henry.
"Let's go."
She was very cool. The gun was cradled in her arm.
"You may want to walk behind me."
Okay. She started walking.
"Jamie!"
"Mom!"
She walked faster. They couldn't have been more than 20 feet from the back door to the Surges Center, maybe 3-4 good paces, no more than that, when the whole thing started. And Vasco Borden was pissed. His trusted assistant just melting right before his eyes. The kid cries, "Mom!" and she lets go of him. She just stands there like she was stunned.
"Hold on to him, damn it," he said. "What are you doing?"
She didn't answer.
"Mom! Mom!"
Exactly what I was worried about, he thought. He had an 8-year-old kid screaming for his mother and all these women in bathrobes walking around. If they weren't looking at him and the kid before, they sure as hell were now, pointing and talking. Vasco appeared completely out of place, 6'4" and bearded, dressed entirely in black, with a black cowboy hat he had had to pull down low because his damn ear had been bitten off. He knew he looked like a bad guy in a bad cowboy movie. His woman wasn't helping. She wasn't soothing the kid or leading him forward, and any minute he knew that kid would turn and bolt. Vasco needed to get control here. He started to reach for his gun, but now more women were coming out of rooms on all sides. Hell, a whole damn yoga class was emptying into the garden to look, to see why some kid was hollering for his mother. And there he was, the man in black. He was screwed.
"Dolly," he snapped. "God damn it. Pull yourself together. We have to take this young man into the Surges Center here."
Vasco never finished the sentence, because a dark shape came streaking toward him, leapt into the air, swung from a tree branch about 8 feet high, and right about the time he realized it was that black kid again, that hairy kid, the one that bit off his ear,
The black kid slammed into him, hard as a big rock, smashing him full in the chest, and Vasco stumbled backward over some rose bushes and went down on his ass, legs up in the air. And that was it. The kid bolted, shrieking for his mom, and Dolly suddenly starts acting like she doesn't know him, and he's cut and scratched, dragging himself out of the rose bushes with no help from her. Can't work up any dignity getting up to your feet with your ass full of thorns. And there's at least 100 people watching him. And any minute, security guards. And the black monkey-looking kid is gone. Can't see him anywhere. Vasco realizes that he's got to get out of there. It's finished. It's a fucking disaster. Dolly is still frozen like the fucking Statue of Liberty, so he starts pushing her, yelling at her to get moving, that they have to leave. All the other women in the garden start booing and hissing. Some old broad in a leotard screams, "Testosterone poisoning!" And the others are yelling, "Leave her alone! Creep! Abuser!" He wants to yell back, "She works for me!" But of course she doesn't anymore. She's dazed and bewildered, and by now the leotard broads are screaming for the police, so it's only going to get worse. Dolly is so slow she might be sleepwalking. Vasco has to get out. He pushes past her, moving through the garden at a half trot, his only thought now to get away, get out of this place. In the next garden, he sees the kid standing with some guy, and in front of the two of them, he sees the broad, Alex. And she's holding a fucking sawed-off 12-gauge like she knows how to use it. Hand on the stock, hand on the action. And she says, "If I ever see your face again, I'll blow it off, asshole." Vasco doesn't answer, just keeps moving past her. And the next thing he knows, there's a fucking explosion. And ahead of him, the bushes along the path just blast away in a green cloud of fluttering petals and leaves and dirt. So, of course, he stops, right there. And he turns, slowly, keeping his hands away from his body. She says, "Did you fucking hear what I said to you?" "Yes, ma'am," he says, always polite to a lady with a gun. Especially if she's upset. Now the crowd is huge. They're 3 or 4 deep, chattering like birds, craning to get a look at what is happening. But this broad's not going to let it go. She yells at him, "What did I say to you?" "You said if you saw me again, you'd kill me." "That's right," she says, "and I will. You touch me or my son again, and I will fucking kill you." "Yes, ma'am," he says. He feels the red rushing into his face. Anger, humiliation, rage. "You can go now," she says, moving the barrel ever so slightly. She knows what she's doing. A lawyer who goes to the shooting range, the worst kind. Vasco nods and moves off quickly as he can. He wants to get away from her and out of sight of all those women. It's like some nightmare. All these women in robes watching him eat shit. In a moment, he's practically running back to the Hummer, away from this place. That's when he saw the black kid, the one who looked like an ape. In fact, he was an ape. Vasco was sure of it, watching the kid move. An ape dressed like a kid, but he was still an ape. The ape was circling around the garden. Just seeing that ape made Vasco's head throb where his ear once was. Without a conscious thought, he pulled out his pistol and started firing. He didn't expect to hit the little fucker at this distance, but he needed to do something. And sure enough, the ape ran, scrambled, went behind a wall, and disappeared. Vasco followed him. It was the damn ladies' room, but nobody was around. The lights in the bathroom were off. He could see the pool off to his right, but nobody was there now. So nobody was in the bathroom, except for the ape. He held his gun and moved forward. Chunk, chunk.
He froze. He knew the sound of a double-action pump. You never went in a room after you heard that sound. He waited.
"Do you feel lucky, punk? Do ya?"
It was a raspy voice. Sounded familiar. He stood there in the doorway to the women's bathroom, angry and afraid, until he began to feel very foolish and very exposed. "Ah, screw it," he said, and he turned and went back to his car. He didn't care about the fucking ape kid anyway. From behind him, a voice said, "My, my, such a lot of guns around town and so few brains." He spun, looked back, but all he saw was that bird flapping its wings as it stood on the door leading to the bathroom. He couldn't tell where the voice had come from. Vasco hurried to his Hummer. Already he was thinking what he would tell the law firm and the Biogen people. Fact was, it just didn't work out. The woman was armed. She was tipped off. Someone had told her in advance. Nothing Vasco could do about that. He was good at his job, but he couldn't work miracles. The problem lay with whoever tipped her off. Before you blame me, take a look at yourself. They had a problem inside their organization. Anyhow, something like that. Adam Winkler lay in the hospital bed, frail and weak. He was bald and pale. His bony hand gripped Josh's.
"Listen," he said, "it wasn't your fault. I was trying to kill myself anyway. It would have happened, no matter what. The time you gave me, you did me a big favor. Look at me. I don't want you blaming yourself."
Josh couldn't speak. His eyes were filled with tears.
"Promise me you won't blame yourself."
Josh nodded.
"Liar."
Adam gave a weak smile.
"How's your lawsuit?"
"Okay," Josh said. "Some people in New York say we gave their mother Alzheimer's. Actually, we gave her water."
"You going to win?"
"Oh, sure." Adam sighed.
"Liar."
His hand relaxed.
"You take care, bro."
And he closed his eyes. Josh panicked, wiped his tears away, but Adam was still breathing. He was sleeping very peacefully. The Oxnard judge coughed in the chilly air as he handed the ruling to the assembled attorneys. Alex Burnett was there, along with Bob Koch and Albert Rodriguez. "As you can see," he said, "I have ruled that Biogen's ownership of Mr. Burnett's cells does not entitle them to take these cells from any individual, living or dead, including Mr. Burnett himself. Certainly the cells cannot be taken from members of his immediate or extended family. Any contrary ruling would conflict with the 13th Amendment forbidding slavery. Within the context of my ruling, I observe that this situation has arisen out of confusion from prior court rulings as to what constitutes ownership in a biological context. First is the notion that material removed from the body is waste or lost material, which is therefore unimportant to the person from whom it was removed. This view is false. If one considers a stillborn fetus, for example, even though it has left the mother's body, we can well intuit that either the mother or